Hello, everybody. Welcome to Blood, Sweat, and Strife. In case you missed our introductory episode, my name is Jeremy. My pronouns are he, him.
I'm Mason, and my pronouns are he, they, she, so whatever you want to call me, I'm still Mason.
And I'm Isabel, and my pronouns are she, her.
Cool. So, yeah, as has been said, our podcast is called Blood, Sweat, and Strife, and this is a podcast about a lot of stuff from not only American history, but history around the world that we wanted to cover in our own way. There's a lot of stuff that, like, we never really got to learn about in school. I'm a victim of the American education system. My two partners and hosts here are also victims of the American education system. And we just wanted to, like, kind of shine a light on some stuff that you might not have known about.
Editor's note, we are not a polycule.
Hear, hear.
Yeah, agreed. And I think victim is definitely the way to put it. Because our education system does a genuinely terrible job.
It does.
Covering all of these aspects of our own nation's history. And it's no wonder why we keep running into these same problems. We keep seeing these same patterns. Is we're literally not taught this stuff. It's intentionally glossed over.
Yeah, very well put.
Including the topic today.
Yeah.
There's a lot of lies by omission, and one of the omissions in my education was the Cold Wars. No, not the Cold War, which was the thing between the West and the Soviet Union, but the Coal Wars, which were a series of labor disputes between miners and coal operators, which kind of, as far as the general time period go, date from like the late 1800s to the early to mid 1900s. We're probably going to end our like in-depth coverage of these events with the 1920s, but we will be talking a little bit about the aftermath of the Cold Wars, as well as, like, the events themselves.
Yeah, and it's funny, actually, you mentioned the Cold War, because literally every time we say Cold War, that's what pops up in my head is Cold War.
Yeah, I have talked to people in real life about this, and they always think I'm talking about the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm literally doing, you know, in-depth study on the subject, and I still am coming up with Cold War in my head every time I hear it.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess we just have to do an episode on that.
Eventually, yeah.
Eventually. God, that would be a big one.
I think I'm the only one of us alive that, like, was alive during the Cold War.
Yeah.
That's true. The Soviet Union had already been dissolved by the time I was born.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too. I mean, like, we've already talked about this a bit, but there is a bit of an age gap on the podcast. I am 22, Jeremy is 27, and Isabel is 41, so we have a nice little spread of perspectives going on here.
We also plan to have guests for discussions that take place outside of our country, as that's not really fair of us to use our voices to gloss over theirs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So yeah, that's kind of who we are and what we want to do. So I think the first thing we should do is we should go over what a company town is.
Well, a company town is almost just that self-explanatory, but obviously it goes a little more in depth than that. Basically, the company, most often a mining company, because it was easier to keep the the employees living close by, would construct small towns or villages where the employees could live. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have to commute, or so, you know, they could keep their mines where the richest deposits of ore and other natural materials were. They would build housing, and they had outhouses and showers, and most often a company store, which was the only place a lot of these people could buy goods at, including the goods that they needed for their jobs. So essentially, they were putting the money they earned from the mine right back into the mine owner's pockets.
Exactly.
Because they provided all this stuff.
Yeah, they were paid in company scrip, which was basically monopoly money, which they, like you just said, they would turn around and give right back to the coal miners. Not the coal miners, the coal operators. And they were also responsible for purchasing all of their own gear. The miners would have to buy their pickaxes, they'd have to buy the dynamite, they would have to buy the special protective gear that would protect them from, like, the gas in the mines. And overall, it was a situation in which you were essentially owned by the company. Like, they owned your housing, they owned the church, they owned the school. So, like, you were getting alongside of this situation where you were just being outright exploited by these companies. They were also controlling you ideologically, which is something that we'll probably get into a little bit more later. But the coal operators admitted themselves that if somebody would come in and start preaching more left-wing rhetoric, which was, like, more sympathetic towards the unions that were trying to form at the time, they would not last very long as a preacher. Same thing with the school teachers. Like, the school teachers were giving these mine workers a firmly anti-communist education because they were afraid that the miners might unionize.
And I think what's interesting about company towns is, or another thing that's interesting about company towns, is they really serve to highlight how even when capitalism manages to find ways of doing things efficiently, it does it in a way that ultimately only maximizes profit.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, it created this circumstance that was kind of a dystopian nightmare for the people that were living there.
Yeah. It's funny that you say dystopian, because in my reading of this, I actually found a lot of people saying that, like, these were attempts on the parts of the mine operators to build utopias for their workers. When that just absolutely wasn't the case. Like, the point was to extract as much profit from them as they possibly could.
Yeah, so this could have been a circumstance. Like, there were ways that this could have been done. Like, I think we can all easily imagine ways this could have been done that wouldn't have been a nightmare for the people there. And it could have been, like, a really efficient way of extracting this resource while still not being hellish for these people.
I mean, yeah, they essentially found a way to have these miners own nothing, because the ones that didn't pay in cash, the ones that paid in company scrip, what, you couldn't buy anything outside of the mining town with it.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You're just stuck with literally nothing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Or whatever they offered you at the company store.
Yeah.
Right.
Company towns get
Which, by the way, they were in charge of stocking. Sorry, Mason.
Oh, that's okay. I was just making a dumb rhyme.
We'll make it.
Company towns get two thumbs down from me. So, yeah, this was the context in which these miners found themselves. They found themselves in a situation in which they owned nothing, and they were completely at the mercy of these mining operators who at times would do things that would really upset the miners, such as...
Oh, I just want to clarify first, real quick. The miners didn't get their housing, given to them. The
No.
money paid to rent their housing was just automatically taken out of their paycheck.
Very good point.
Including the money to use the showers. It was all taken out directly before they were actually paid.
Yeah. Yeah, so this was the context that the miners found themselves in. They owned nothing. They were completely at the mercy of the company. And the coal operators themselves were at the mercy of the market. Now, I'm not an economist, so I'm not particularly able to describe these market forces in detail. However, there was a great article that I read called "The Effect of Competitive Conditions on Labor Relations in Coal Mining." And according to this article, coal had and has a tendency towards overproduction, which would result in lower coal profits or lower coal prices, which would then result in lower profits for the mine operators. And then when the operators needed to make up that lost profit in some way, they would just cut the wages of the workers. So you would see this tendency where during coal booms, wages would actually go up. But then during the bust, wages would suddenly slash, be like slashed. and there was a lot of competition between union and non-union fields. We are trying to make this as accessible to everybody as possible, so first of all, I think we should describe what a union is and what a union does. So basically, a union is an organization of workers that brings them together, and they can organize for better wages, better hours, better conditions through the process of collective bargaining, which basically just means you have union representatives, which are elected by the workers, who operate as middlemen between the coal operators and the miners. And the miners would essentially try to get the best deal they possibly could. They wanted better wages, hours, and conditions. And we're going to go into the specific demands of the unions, but needless to say, the coal companies really did not like unions. One of the economic forces that we saw emerging during this time period of the late 1800s and the early 1900s was this competition between union and non-union fields. So there was the central competitive field, which was made up of Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, which were essentially controlled by the union people, and they were able to get an 8-hour workday, a standard wage for men working on a daily basis, and a standard tonnage weight. The tonnage weight is important because the coal operators would, when they didn't have a standard tonnage weight, they would encourage the miners to load up the cars as full with coal as they possibly could, which was actually very dangerous because due to, like, exceeding the weight capacity, the mine cars would, like, crash and explode and, like, that sort of thing. And establishing a standard tonnage weight of 2,000 pounds was important because of this reason. It made things a lot safer. You also had the Southwest Interstate Field, which was made up of Oklahoma, Arkansas, Missouri, and Kansas. And then you had more Union territory, which was Pennsylvania, Michigan, Iowa, Wyoming, Montana, North Dakota, and Western Kentucky. And then you had the non-union fields, which are going to be very important. These were places in much of Virginia, Eastern Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Texas, New Mexico, parts of Colorado, Utah, and Washington. So the non-union fields had the advantage of the operators being able to just cut wages however they pleased, and this led to higher profits for the non-union fields. The union fields, on the other hand, they had like an 8-hour day, they had a standard tonnage weight, they had guaranteed higher wages because it was part of their contract. So on the whole, the union fields were less profitable than the non-union fields. And this was why the coal operators fought the union so hard.
It's not like the fields weren't competitive, though, right? It's not like they weren't profitable still. It's just they weren't as profitable as they maximally could be.
Exactly.
The union fields, right? So, and I think it's important to say that because this isn't about, oh, business owners is doing what they need to survive, because they were already doing that. This was about more. This was about literally driving people into the ground to make extra money.
Yeah.
And yeah, we'll have some good examples of that later on as well.
Yeah. We're going to get deep into this stuff. So yeah, that was a little look of the economy at the time. Now we have the question, what was it actually like in the mines? And I believe that Jeremy is the most, like, well-versed on this, so I'll let him take it.
Okay, so now, obviously, to this day, you hear of coal miners having improper conditions, whether it be ventilation or a lack of structures to prevent cave-ins. Imagine all of this, but ramped up to 11, because part of the things that these unionized miners were fighting for were sort of the safety features that we see mostly implemented in mines today. Stuff like adequate lighting or ventilation shafts to make it so they can breathe clean air, testing kits to make sure that they're not breathing in toxic fumes and gases, I'm sure everyone's heard the old canary story where, you know, miners bring a canary down into the mine, and if the canary dies, you're probably breathing in carbon monoxide.
Yeah.
And of course, there's the after effects, like black lung, where you get a buildup of coal dust on your lungs that never really goes away. It's similar to mesothelioma, I think, in symptoms. But I'm not a doctor. Don't quote me on that. They would face cave-ins that would either trap the miners inside until they suffocated or starved if they weren't able to be gotten out in time, or just outright crush people. Especially the entrances of the mines would collapse a lot because the wooden, you know, the wooden archways that they would put up wouldn't be adequate to hold the weight of the tumbling rock.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a good picture of what was going on down there.
Yeah.
Lighting was a big one. I mean, that wasn't wholly the fault of the companies, because lighting wasn't as sophisticated as it is today. But it still, they didn't help the situation, I'll say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they did have access at the time of the later part of this story anyway. They had access to, you know, portable electric lights. They did exist. They didn't look like modern flashlights, but they were there. They were used heavily during World War I, in fact. So
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Part of the issue with, like, the old helmet lights and everything is keeping them powered or keeping the bulbs from burning out.
Right.
And, of course, when their bulbs burned out, guess where they had to buy them from?
The company store.
The company store.
Hell yeah. We love the company store.
We do. Where company stands.
Yeah. So yeah, that was all very well put. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. So that's a little bit about what it was like in the mines and what the economy of the time was like and just what it was like being a coal miner. So now I guess we'll get into the actual, labor battles that happened, starting with the Cripple Creek Strike, right? And the Colorado Labor Wars.
Yeah, 1894.
Okay, tell me all about it.
So, the Cripple Creek Miners' Strike of 1894. Just a little bit of brief background information first. It lasted about 5 months. The strike was carried out by the Western Federation of Miners, which was one of the unions of the time. It was relatively small. The strikers actually ended up coming out on top for the most part. They won't get everything that they were asking for, but the conditions were improved for them. And it was the only time ever in the history of the United States that a state militia would be called out in support of the striking workers rather than to crush the opposition. Even to this day, I don't think a state militia has ever been called out to assist the actual workers. It's usually to help the company.
What factors do you think led to the state militia being called out to support the striking workers?
I would say that was mostly pressure that the strikers were putting on the infrastructure and the economy of the time. I think it pushed the state to want to sort of get things over as bloodlessly as possible. And the governor of Colorado at the time was actually a populist, and he would be the last populist to ever be elected, as we'll talk about later. But he was sort of lenient on the strikers. He was on their side. But yeah, that's a good brief.
That's going to be uncommon in a lot of these stories, is having anybody in the government actually on the striker's side.
And we will see how the coal operators managed to get the government on their side, because there's a wealth of information about that.
Yeah, this sort of actually leads into this was one of the earlier ones, not the earliest, but it shows a lot of what led to the other events we'll be discussing.
Mm-hmm.
But so, at the tail end of the 1800s, Cripple Creek was the largest town in the gold mining district in Colorado. And in 1891, they found surface gold in the area, and it only took them 3 years to develop 150 mines.
Wow.
Yeah.
They work fast.
They do. They work very fast.
Yeah.
It's funny, they're efficient when they can extract profit and resources. Mm-hmm. The silver prices crashed in 1893, but the gold prices were fixed by the federal government because of the gold standard that the U.S. used to operate on. And a lot of the silver miners from the mines that were closing down due to the lack of demand would rush into the gold mines for employment, which caused a general lowering of the wages in the gold mines. And mine owners themselves started trying to get people to work more hours for less pay. Mm-hmm. And then in 1894, the mine owners of Cripple Creek, being J.J. Hagerman, David Moffat, and Eben Smith, just those three people employed one-third of the entire area's miners. Not just the Cripple Creek miners, one-third of the entire the gold mining district.
Yeah.
And they announced that they would be increasing their working day from 8 hour to 10, but keeping their wage at $3 a day.
I would be pretty angry.
So they're basically, And the people were angry. The miners began to protest, and the owners agreed that they would lower the workday back down to 8 hours, but they lowered the wage to $2.50 a day.
So then how are the miners supposed to afford like all the stuff that they have to buy from the company store and their rent? Because
that's a significant decrease in pay.
That's a huge decrease. It is. Especially back then when the dollar wasn't as inflated as it is now.
I mean, think about it this way. It's a sixth of your paycheck.
Yeah, yep. Absolutely.
But and the company stores set their own prices. Like, the company decided what you were paying for your goods. They could take away your entire paycheck just by making your necessities cost that much.
Yeah, there are so many instances of the mine operators, like, either raising the rent or raising the price of groceries and not raising wages. And oftentimes this has led to company towns just getting burned down. So,
based.
Yeah. I believe, I remember reading a little bit about the Pullman riots, where millions of dollars worth of property were destroyed by angry workers who had recently had their rent raised, but their wages remained stagnant. So they were basically just like, what the fuck? We're about to lose our homes. And that resulted in a massive riot.
And what did they expect?
I can't really seem surprised.
Yeah, it's like, sometimes I have to wonder, what did they expect to happen? You know what exactly. I mean? Like, it kind of just goes to show there's this constant disconnection between reality and where these people sit in the upper tiers of finances.
I mean, they were literally, like, paying their workers pennies, and they were still making, like, massive profits. Like, they had the money to pay the miners, it's just that they didn't want to.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the meme where the guy shoots the person sitting in the chair, and he's like, who could have done this?
How could he have done this to himself?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's capitalism in a nutshell. Exactly. Literally that meme over and over and over again.
Yeah.
It's like the Ouroboros, or
the snake eating his own ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Some people might get that joke. So, shortly before the owners attempted to lower the wages and increase the working hours, the Cripple Creek miners formed the Free Coinage Union, which eventually became absorbed into the Western Federation of Miners, or the WFM, and it became their Local 19 district, which is just how the unions at the time sort of organized their force, I suppose. But continuing on, February 1894, the mine owners implemented the 10-hour workday, despite the backlash they'd received prior, and the union president, John Calderwood, sent out a notice within a week of this happening to the owners, demanding that they reinstate the 8-hour workday and the $3 a day wage, but was completely ignored.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't get a rejection, they just straight up ignored it.
Wow. The coal operators literally said, here's a phone, call somebody who cares.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They checked under their big, tall smokestack hats for their fucks, and they didn't see any. But after this, the miners would organize a strike on February 7th, and some of the smaller mines agreed to their conditions, but the larger mines with more resources and capital would hold out quite a bit longer. As, you know, that's sort of obvious. They had the ability to do so.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But the strike actually had an immediate effect, and by the end of February, every smelter in Colorado was either closed or only running part-time.
That's incredible.
And oh, yeah, yeah, it is. And at the beginning of March, the Gold King and Granite Mines would give in and actually resume their 8-hour workday, and they were two of the larger ones that were holding out.
Did they say if they got their $3 an hour or $3 a day paychecks reinstated as well?
I'm actually not sure. I think they did because that was part of the strikers' demands.
Right.
But right. Later on, you'll find that the even larger holdouts came back with, I think, a $2.75 a day wage.
Gotcha.
Yeah, they kind of compromised. Like I said, the larger holdouts were still not opening. But they attempted to. On March 14th, they got a court injunction ordering the striking miners to not interfere with their mining operations, and they tried to hire strike breakers, which will, from here on out, I believe, be referred to as scabs.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The WFM actually tried to unionize the scabs, and it didn't work, unfortunately. But they drove them out with threats and violence, which, I mean, you may or may not agree with that, but it worked.
Was that the situation where the National Guard actually basically tortured one of the union strikers for attempting to unionize the scabs?
No, this was before that.
Yeah. Oh, okay, gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Things would escalate later on. But, so, on March 16th, an armed group of miners would ambush and capture six sheriff's deputies who were on their way to the Victor Mine. A fight broke out because of this. One of the deputies was shot, and another was beaten with a club.
Jeez.
Hmm.
So these miners were not happy.
Yeah.
And they didn't want Johnny Law interfering.
No. Because all Johnny Law had to bring to the table was, you know, more help for the bosses.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what they're there for.
Yep.
The state militia would get involved after this. The sheriff of El Paso County, his last name's Bowers, I'm going to refer to him as such, sent out a telegram to the governor requesting the state militia, which would later become the Colorado National Guard. And Governor Davis Waite dispatched 300 troops on March 18th, who were under the command of Adjutant General T.J. Tarsney, who had been assured that the union members were going to cooperate with the state militia being involved, including surrendering to arrest if they were asked to do so. Now, Tarsney believed that Bowers had hyperbolized the situation, and he said that he thinks the militia should be withdrawn, and there was nothing that they could do there. So the militia actually left on March 20th, and the mine owners had to close their mines again because the strikes continued, obviously. Sheriff Bowers would then arrest Calderwood, the union president, 18 miners, and the mayor and the town marshal of the town of Altman, who were also supporting the miners. They were brought to Colorado Springs and tried on several different charges, but were found not guilty.
I see.
And after this, the union miners and the scabs would continue to clash more frequently, and the striking miners would allegedly go on to steal guns and ammunition.
I mean, that's just kind of what you have to do in that situation. Like, you're dealing with, like, violent confrontations with people who are there to break the strike. So it just makes sense to take their guns from them and their ammunition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. These people were literally showing up with this gun and these guns and ammunition to inflict harm on them. I don't see a problem with that.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I mean, if someone's using violence on you, you should be able to defend yourself in whatever way you can.
Exactly. Yeah, especially under conditions like these when we need to keep in mind, like, the mine operators were packing heat themselves. Like, oftentimes they would call in these private detective agencies, and they would hire company guards with guns, and eventually, like, they got to the point where they were deputizing, like, thousands of people, like, on the spot to just fight against the miners. And that's all stuff we'll get into, like, a little bit later.
Oh, yeah. This actually leads directly into the usage of detective agencies becoming more popular.
Oh, well, there you go.
But at the end of March and early May, the owners and the union reps sat down to discuss some terms. The mine owners offered to return to the 8-hour workday, but with a wage decrease of $3 to $2.75, and the union would reject that offer. And then afterwards, the mine owners would meet with Sheriff Bowers and asked if they could bring in scabs, hundreds of scabs, and if they could be protected by the sheriff. Bowers would say that the county lacked resources, they couldn't afford to pay more than a few deputies, and they didn't have enough guns for them. Right. And the mine owners offered to subsidize this, which is funny because they wouldn't pay their employees their full wage, but they would pay however many thousands of dollars it would take to fund and arm all of these men they were calling in.
It's like the SpongeBob joke where Patrick eats all the candy bars and he's just like, I have nothing left. Now I'm gonna starve.
This is one of those really direct examples, though, of business, of capitalists utilizing a government agency like the police and bending it to their will directly with cash injections.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, that it's just they literally went out and bought the authority of the sheriff.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the exact same thing happening to this day, but it's done in a different way.
Yeah, we see private ownership of public officials all the time. Yeah. We see billions of dollars spent in lobbying every year, and for every dollar that is spent on lobbying, the companies get, I think, like $7 back. So it's not like they're doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. And we have public officials who, in some cases, their interests are literally the exact same as the coal operators. Like, the current governor of West Virginia, which we'll get into in a little bit more depth later, is actually the CEO of a bunch of coal companies. Like, I don't see how you could get, like, any more obvious with it. It seems like it's gotten more obvious.
Right.
I mean, they just keep it out of the 24-hour news coverage, and people aren't going to hear about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
But yeah, so Sheriff Bowers agreed to allow the operators to fund this influx of troops, and he began recruiting ex-cops and ex-firefighters from Denver, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the news of this would reach the miners, so they started organizing themselves further and gathering up more firearms in defense, because they were going to be attacked by this incoming force.
Right.
And Calderwood was preparing for a fundraising trip because, you know, taking care of all this stuff costs a lot of money. And he appointed Junius Johnson as the commander of the strike operations, who was actually, I believe, an Army veteran.
Can we just say Junius J. Johnson is a really badass name?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He sounds like he wants pictures of Spider-Man on his desk. But he would go on to establish a camp on Bull Hill, which was a small hill, I guess, not quite a mountain, overlooking the town of Altman. He ordered fortifications to be built, a commissary to be stocked, and to have the miners drilled in military maneuvers in preparation of what was to come.
Wow. So they weren't playing around anymore at this point.
No, I mean, they knew this force was coming, so right. They had to prepare. And it only gets worse. On May 24th, the strikers would seize the Strong Mine. That's what it was called. That's the actual title of the mine, the Strong Mine, on Battle Mountain, which overlooked the town of Victor. And the morning following, 125 deputies would arrive in Altman to move up the mountain in an attack on the strikers' camp. So to defend against this, the miners would blow up the mine's shaft house and the steam boiler, which blew loads of wood and iron and steel debris into the air, which pelted the incoming force and caused them to flee the mountain. And they actually got on the train to leave town. Yeah, these guys were not... they weren't really invested in this as much as the miners were. It wasn't their livelihood.
Yeah.
Right, right.
The miners went into the town, and this is something that, you know, I don't think they should have done, but they stole a bunch of liquor from warehouses and saloons in the town of Altman and started getting drunk. They loaded up a flat car, which is like, you know, those train car, the little hand-operated mine cars you see in cartoons. They loaded up one with dynamite and attempted to blow up the camp that the deputies had set up.
So they legit got drunk off of stolen liquor and then tried to make a rolling bomb?
Yes. Yeah.
That is wild.
Not the best self-preservation skills.
Love that.
But this bomb would stop short and actually end up killing a cow.
Oh my god. So really... That cow did nothing wrong.
No, it didn't.
Well, I changed my whole mind about this. I'm pro mine boss now. Fuck those miners.
Yeah. Fuck the miners.
Yeah.
Stop the strike.
They blew up a cow, okay?
Shooting on non-union scabs, that's one thing. Blowing up a cow, that's a step too far.
Yeah, it's true.
Out of curiosity, was Altman a company town?
Altman, I don't believe, was.
Okay. I was going to say, if Altman was a company town, then technically speaking, the stolen liquor would have been from the company anyway.
Yeah, that's true. But no, I don't think it was. It was a larger town than that.
Gotcha.
Some of the miners, with more extreme takes, wanted to blow up every single mine in the region. And some of their cohorts and I believe Junius himself had to talk them out of it. A handful of the miners that had been drinking stole a work train from the mine site, and they caught up with the fleeing deputies, the ones who they had blown shrapnel onto, which resulted in a firefight between the two groups. Yeah, they chased them down while drunk to have a shootout. This is like some Red Dead Redemption shit. I don't know.
Really is, honestly.
Yeah. One of the deputies and one miner died. A man on each side was wounded, and six of the strikers were captured. The miners, in retaliation, managed to capture three officials from the strong mine. I don't know if they were lower management, or if they were the actual owners, or if they were foremen or what. But
right.
They captured them, and both sides agreed on a prisoner exchange, and everybody captured got to go free. Now, Calderwood returned that night from his fundraising expedition to this catastrophe that was going on. He asked the saloons to close and had several of the disruptive miners arrested, which is not based.
Unfortunate.
Yeah. On May 26th, the mine owners would again meet with Sheriff Bowers, and they wanted to provide additional funding to bring in 1,200 more deputies. 1,200 additional armed men to stop this strike. And Bowers agreed.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were bringing in a literal army to stop these striking miners.
The extent that they were willing to go to at this point, just to not pay their miners an extra quarter a day.
It's so stubborn and spiteful. Yeah.
It's just... Yep. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
It's absolutely ridiculous.
They're willing to pay 1,200 additional people however much money they want for, like, however many days they're going to be stuck there.
Yeah. They were probably thinking, like, we'll build this private army, we'll make an example out of these miners, we'll show them not to fuck with the coal operators, and then down the road we won't have to deal with this sort of labor unrest.
That's what they were thinking of right there. They were playing the long game with it.
Yeah.
They were thinking about not just this strike, but every strike that might come on down the road.
Yeah.
And they wanted to send, they wanted to make an example of these people for daring to want a little bit better for themselves.
Yeah, and I think that really helps make sense of, like, a lot of the just abject cruelty that I've read about, like, in doing research for this podcast. Like, they wanted it to be clear that, like, if you went on strike, you could die.
Yeah.
Yeah. Striking, it's never really a decision that people make. It's something that gets rammed down your throat after a while. It's something that happens after you are forced to accept a pay cut and everything else has gotten more expensive. So your options are, I can either die on the street, or I can die fighting for a better life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And look at how the narrative is always sold in all of this. It's yeah. always, the onus is always on the strikers for resisting.
Yeah.
And not on the owners for operating their facilities in such a horrible manner.
Exactly. Like, it's like when a cop shoots a guy. Like, the onus is always on the victim for resisting arrest or for
right.
whatever crime they might have been doing.
Right. As if, you know, jaywalking is suddenly a crime that carries a death sentence if the person runs away.
Yeah.
That's the mindset that a lot of these people seem to have. And it's ingrained into them. Like, that sort of mindset is... It doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen by accident. It's put there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's very well put. And I mean, you'll find that things haven't changed much over the years. I mean, if anything, strikes have become less effective.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you have strikes now with Starbucks workers and, like, service industry workers and, like...
Right.
A lot of the
There's
time,
been some encouraging developments in that area in the last year or two.
There have been,
you know, like
there definitely have
yeah,
been.
Yeah. It's definitely, you know, important to acknowledge that. I think.
Yeah, but like the thing is, these companies
are so
massive.
I think part of
that
is they're forming new unions rather than relying on the corporate unions that exist now.
Right. Yeah. Right. And that's what I think. That's the big thing right there is, which we're going to touch on a little bit later on with corporate unions, but. That's the big thing. That's where we see a lot of these movements coming from is these are new unions. These are new people. And it's a lot of new blood and a lot of people with relatively clean hands.
A lot of the people who are organizing these service industry unions are actually very young. Like... My cat's yelling at me. What do you want, boy? What do you want? Okay, so what was I saying? Yeah, a lot of the people organizing these unions are very young. They're like people my age, which right. is super encouraging.
Right. A lot of these new organizers, I think probably 90% of them are under the age of 30.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm
pulling that completely out of my ass, by the way.
Oh,
so
yeah.
This is my read on it. You know what I mean? I don't want to be quoted on that, but yeah.
I think the main public organizer for the Amazon situation going on, I believe he's in his mid-20s.
Yeah.
Is that
but I'm not exactly
Chris
sure.
Smalls?
Yeah, I believe so.
I see. Makes sense.
Is he in his 20s? No, he's in his early 30s. Mm-hmm. Still pretty young.
Well, when did he start, though? Because if he's like real early 30s, because he's been working on that for like 3 years now.
Yeah, 2015 is when he started working at Amazon.
Oh, goodness. Yeah.
I don't know if that's when he started the labor
right,
movement, but that's
right.
when he started working there. He's still very young, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean,
okay,
so.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, I mean, the reality is that my generation is just not as radical, and it never really was. And I think y'all's generation is coming up in a world that is it's vastly different from the world that I grew up in
mm-hmm.
and that my generation grew up in. And You're kind of coming out of the gates already, like, pretty radicalized in a lot of ways. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. I mean, at this point, it's life or death for us.
Yeah.
Right.
So, the governor of Colorado, Davis Waite, was warned of this new, larger deputized force and issued a proclamation on May 27th, which called for the miners to disband their encampment on Bull Hill, while at the same time also declaring the 1,200 deputies to be an illegal force and immediately ordering the group to be disbanded.
Hmm.
He ordered the state militia to keep an eye on Cripple Creek, anticipating the incoming attack, because he knew that the order of disbandment wouldn't be effective. On May 28th, Governor Waite visited the miners and gave him authorization to negotiate their terms on their behalf.
Wow. That's actually like a fairly significant like sign of show of trust on the part of the miners to the governor there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the governor was, he wasn't entirely on their side, but he was very sympathetic to their cause.
Yeah. He at the very least made it clear that he wasn't willing to just stand by and do nothing while 1,200 armed thugs came marching through and crushed them.
Yeah. So, the combined force of 1,300 deputies from all over the state of Colorado were in Cripple Creek now, and Sheriff Bowers found that he could not control these people. They didn't recognize him as any sort of commander, and they moved into the town of Altman on June 5th as sort of a prelude to moving up Bull Hill and storming the striking workers' encampment. The deputies would cut the telegraph and the telephone lines leading out of town and imprison some of the reporters there who were trying to shed some light on the situation for the rest of the country. They didn't want any of this to get out because it made them look bad. It made the sheriff look bad. It made the company owners look bad. So it was, what's the word for that? When you want to keep things like under control or on the down low,
covert,
buttoned up,
I don't know, something like that. There's like a specific term. It's on the tip of my tongue. Can't remember. But moving on, there was concern that the deputies would escalate things further. So Governor Waite would dispatch the state militia under the command of one General E.J. Brooks. He was moving the militia in to defend the strikers against this impromptu force. And on June 6th, the militia would arrive to an already progressing system of violence. The deputies had advanced on the encampment on Bull Hill, and the two parties were shooting at each other. So General Brooks moved his troops to the base of the hill and actually met with Bowers, because remember, Bowers was no longer in control of these deputies. So these two opposing commanding officers met with each other to discuss what to do, because one man's troops were just out of control.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Like,
No, continue. Go ahead.
No, I'm blown away right now. You know, like, yeah, that just kind of gives you an idea of how, like, they must have had these guys fired up. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I mean, it's ludicrous. It's like a Looney Tunes situation.
Right.
But, well, the two commanding officers were having their discussion. The deputies would make use of this lull in command to move even further up the hill to try to charge the miners' camp. The miners would blow the whistle at the Victor Mine, which alerted General Brooks, and he then sent his troops to intercept the deputies on their charge, and they occupied Bull Hill in its entirety. The miners didn't resist this. They knew that the militia had come in to protect them, so they just allowed them to do their thing and set up their camps. The deputies returned to the town and started just arresting people and putting them in jail who weren't involved in the situation.
That's so weird.
Just like random townsfolk, they would be pulled off the streets, out of taverns, pulling people out of their homes and just beating them.
Holy shit.
They
these people were enervated.
Yeah. And, like, it just kind of goes to show that, like, you can go pretty far if you're somebody who's willing to use excessive force.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're given that much power, you're bound to abuse it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, I was just... I'm flabbergasted by this.
Oh, yeah. None of these deputies ever saw the inside of a jail cell, did they?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
I don't know if you guys remember the spanking train or whatever from SpongeBob, where they just had a line of people and they would, like, spank each other. Like, you would go in everybody's legs and then at the end you would get spanked. You remember that?
I do remember that.
I do not, but continue.
So the deputies, they formed sort of a gauntlet or, like, a coop on the street. And forced citizens to pass through it while they would slap, spit, and kick them as they went
Holy
by.
Holy shit.
For whatever reason.
Oh my god.
I have no idea what was going on in these people's brains, but they were here in full force.
Yeah.
The militia began detaining the deputies after they had successfully taken over Bull Mountain. And by nightfall of that same day, they managed to have things mostly under control. Governor Waite threatened to enact martial law, and the mine owners refused to disband this force of deputies.
So even the federal government is like, well, state government in this case, but even the state government is telling the mine operators that they need to stop. And they're just like, yes, right. No.
It's like, I am literally going to put the military in charge and kick all of your deputies out and shut down your mines.
Yeah.
But no, they refused.
So stubborn.
Yeah.
So General Brooks threatened to keep the militia in that area for another 30 days. And then the mine owners would agree to disband the deputies because they didn't want to pay them anymore if they couldn't do anything. And with the militia there, they wouldn't be able to act because the militia was obviously a stronger force and had already quelled them in this one town. So
that literally gives away, like, what they had planned to do the whole time. They were just going to wait for the militia to go away and then right back to terrorizing the town.
Mm-hmm.
And they were going to keep doing it until the mine workers broke.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm sure if they didn't have to pay the people for their 30-day stay, they probably still would have done it after the 30 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Once the militia left then. But
I just had a thought. Maybe terrorizing the townspeople was a tactic to try to get the townspeople against the strikers. Because the conclusion that, like, some people might come to is, like, none of this would have happened if the strikers hadn't gone on strike.
Right.
Yeah, that's something that'll help us out later. Keep that in mind.
Okay.
Sorry, this is kind of a long one.
No, don't worry.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, the owners did not want to pay the force that couldn't act, so they agreed to disband. On June 11th, they officially disbanded. They all went away, and the Waite Agreement came into effect, which was Governor Waite's agreement on behalf of the miners with the mine operators. And the miners returned to work that same day. Calderwood, who, if we remember, is the president of the UMW at the time, and 300 other miners were arrested. Only 4 of them were convicted, and then the governor pardoned those 4. So nice. He was very much on the side of the miners for the most part.
That's very cool. Yeah.
None of the miners got in trouble for this.
It was one of those things, if he wasn't already pretty on their side when he went out there, his experience there would have turned him all the way. You know what I mean? If
yeah.
he was
even oh, yeah.
at all sympathetic to them, because the stuff he would have seen was, you know, it was terrible.
Right. And here's where we're going to introduce some of the stuff that this event sort of kicked off for the rest of our story here. The WFM would use the success of the situation, since the miners mostly got what they wanted, to get almost every worker in the Cripple Creek region organized in a union, including waitresses, laundry workers, bartenders, and newsboys. Nice. So not just miners anymore.
Hell yeah.
They were flourishing. They helped in the elections of county officials, including the new sheriff to replace Bowers, who was a twat. they were massively impacted in a positive way in this early stage. a lot of the miners throughout the whole western part of the region would come to admire the unions and want to organize themselves. Thousands of more workers would join over the next few years. There were politicians and labor officials who were allying themselves with the union, but their successes at Cripple Creek were levied against them as well by employers, company owners, who would come to label them as being violent and dangerous. During a strike attempt in Cripple Creek in 1898, the public support of the union would shift almost entirely after some outbreaks of violence would happen in the town. Waite, yep. Governor Waite, having been soft on the miners, would end up losing the next election to a Republican because the company owners probably lobbied against him because he was soft on the miners. And the populist political party in Colorado would never have another person elected. They wow. just were completely shut out forever to this day, which would happen to a lot of left-wing parties around this time period.
Propaganda is a hell of a thing.
Oh, yeah, it is. The mine owners would start using new strategies after all this, and the new governor, McIntyre, would form an alliance between the state government and the mine owners. They started using detective companies like the Pinkertons, which a lot of people have probably heard of, the Field Detective Service, not quite yet, but later on the Baldwin-Felt Detective Agency. They would use these detectives, quote-unquote, as spies and thugs, and they increased their usage of scabs, and they would start implementing lockouts, which they would block the miners out of the mines so they couldn't go to work, and then bring in scabs who weren't union members. And they would blacklist union members, so if they were fired or they quit or whatever, they couldn't be hired anywhere else.
They'll use every trick in the book.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's actually, I read an article that put forth this idea that the coal operators and the factory owners and like, basically, the capitalists employing these workers would provoke strikes on purpose using tactics like cutting their wages, and then they would break the strike forcefully and blacklist all of the miners or all of the whatever workers were working for that enterprise. And this caused unions across the country to just hemorrhage membership. It resulted in like a pretty sharp decline. So, yeah.
It's really unfortunate.
I think that wraps up Cripple Creek, right?
Yep.
Okay.
And that pretty much leads into, that was like the impetus for all of the other horrible things that would be done to the strikers.
Yeah. Hello.
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 Hi.
It's you been look so long. Tonight. So do you.
Yeah.
We all look beautiful tonight. And
we all are beautiful.
Yeah. We're just dropping into the episode to explain why that cut is so weird. So, when we first recorded these episodes, we planned on just doing it all in one go, but then that turned into a 4-hour long thing. And then we were like, shit, we have 4 episodes. So that's why this cut is here, and we're just explaining that.
Yeah. And this is going to sound like dramatically different compared perhaps to the rest of the show, because it's been about a year since we originally did these recordings, and we've all gotten new audio equipment since then.
Yeah. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed the show, and look out for the next episode coming in about 2 weeks.